It was a cold and rainy evening on October 3rd, 1845, and despite the gloomy weather, the city of Baltimore was buzzing with life after the tumultuous election earlier that day. Election days were notorious for being disorderly, corrupt, and sometimes even violent. Navigating his way through the crowds of people, Joseph Walker made his way to Gunner's Hall, a local tavern doubling as a polling place. As he approached, he spotted a shadowy figure sprawled in a ditch. Initially, it seemed like he had stumbled upon a lifeless body, but upon closer inspection, he was shocked to discover that it was none other than the renowned mystery writer Edgar Allan Poe clinging to life. In a state of delirium and barely coherent, Poe, who had been missing for the past 6 days, was unable to shed light on how he ended up outside the tavern fighting for his life, or why he was dressed in someone else's clothes. He was rushed to a nearby hospital, where he spent the next 4 days drifting in and out of consciousness, rambling nonsensically, experiencing hallucinations, and battling high fevers, until his untimely demise on October 7th at just the age of 40. But what led to the death of the father of the detective story? Was it an accident? Was it self-inflicted? Or perhaps it was something more sinister? Today, I'm telling you the tale of Edgar Allan Poe and the mysterious death of the Master of Macabre. Hello, everyone. I'm your host, Megan, and welcome back to Haunted History. I have some exciting news to share. We just launched our website. Woohoo! So you can check it out at hauntedhistorypod.com. And I feel like the newer generations are going to be like, so what's the big deal about a website? But if you're a millennial or older, you'll remember that back in the early 2000s, not just anyone could make a website. It's not at all like today where you can just use an app or something. So it was always, you know, a big accomplishment when you finally got your website done. So naturally, when we got ours done, I was feeling a little proud. But then my daughter just casually goes, oh yeah, I made one last year for fun. I was like, oh man, how times are changing. So yeah, that rained on my parade a bit, but you can definitely check it out if you're interested. We will have, you know, our show notes, sources, updates, you know, all that good stuff. I can't wait for you guys to hear this week's episode. Researching this one was a lot of fun, but there is a boatload of information out there, way more than I anticipated. So it was impossible to mention everything that I researched, so I really tried my best to kind of pick out the key elements of Edgar's story. But one thing I notice, you know, with historical stories like these, the accounts can vary slightly. And of course, maybe that's just how the information is being interpreted, especially, for example, you know, all we have to go by are letters. So you have to keep that in mind. And if you want more or you want to deep dive into any of this yourself, there's countless biographies, shows, documents, letters that you can, you know, take a look into. And I also want to mention that there is an Edgar Allan Poe Museum, and it's in Richmond, Virginia. And it's got a lot of artifacts and collections of things that were actually owned by Edgar. And overall, it looks like a really cool experience. So if you are ever in that area, then stop on by for a visit and tag us. All right, now I've chatted enough. Let's get to today's story. Edgar Allan Poe is a name that resonates with many. Even if you haven't read his writing directly, chances are you've encountered something influenced by the Master of Macabre, be it a film, a TV show, or another author's work. For instance, there are movies like The Raven with John Cusack and The Pale Blue Eye with Christian Bale and Gillian Anderson. And then there's the gothic horror series The Fall of the House of Usher on Netflix. Poe's legacy lives on through various mediums, inspiring creators like Stephen King, aka the King of Horror, and even the legendary Alfred Hitchcock. Despite his enduring influence, Poe's death remains shrouded in mystery, sparking many theories about how he met his end. Today, we'll explore some of those theories, but first, let's explore his background for potential clues to his untimely demise. Edgar Poe, the Allen would come later, was born in 1809 in Boston, Massachusetts. Boston at this point was a vibrant hub, brimming with possibilities. The city was expanding at a rapid pace, bringing both exciting prospects and daunting obstacles. Edgar's parents, David and Eliza Poe, were accomplished actors who traveled and performed in different cities in the United States. Eliza, Edgar's mother, immigrated from England as a child and made her debut on the American stage at the tender age of 9. Despite being so young, she received a lot of praise for her acting skills, and by the time she turned 15, she had already mastered over 70 different roles. It was in Richmond that she crossed paths with David Poe, Edgar's future father, as they were cast opposite one another in a production. Over the next few years, the Poes embarked on a journey filled with adventures, sharing the stage and creating magic together. Initially, it appeared to be a perfect match. Eliza had mesmerizing talent and was a captivating beauty, and she received endless accolades. However, for David, things were not as smooth. Plagued by crippling stage fright, he constantly fumbled through his lines and delivered his performances with a lackluster charm. The harsh newspaper critics spared no mercy, routinely publishing not-so-kind reviews that labeled his efforts as nothing short of an embarrassment. David, the aspiring actor who defied his parents' wishes by abandoning his law studies, harbored a deep-seated resentment and anger towards his lack of success compared to his wife's. And despite portraying charming characters on stage, his true reputation was that he was hot-tempered and impulsive. In fact, one time, in a fit of anger, he stormed into a critic's home to vent his frustration over a recent review. Eliza and David welcomed Henry, Edgar's brother, in 1807 during their break from performing. Shortly after, they made the decision to make Boston their home, and they were back on the stage in no time. But this return to the stage was short-lived, as Eliza announced her second pregnancy in 1809, this time with Edgar. And then, like a true superhero, just 3 weeks after Edgar's birth, Eliza, who at this point was a sought-after actress, was back on stage once again. David, Eliza, and the boys eventually made the move to New York in search of a fresh start at the Park Street Theater. David probably thought that a change of scenery might bring some success his way. Unfortunately for him, the critics in New York were just as harsh as those in Boston, and they heavily criticized his performances, even resorting to mocking his appearance by calling him a muffin face. As David struggled to find success, he turned to alcohol, leading to a downward spiral of lost work and financial mismanagement. His reputation ultimately suffered because he would frequently become too drunk to perform, and this eventually led to him being recast in productions. Frustrated and jealous of his wife's success, David eventually abandoned his family, leaving behind a mystery of his whereabouts and fate. Eliza found herself with two young children to care for and another on the way. Yes, she was pregnant and pushing herself to the limit to provide for her family. Despite her best efforts, the stress and financial burdens continued to grow. It's not clear if David knew she was pregnant before he left. There's a possibility that he didn't, but there's also a possibility that that was the very reason why he left. Although, there had been some rumors that it was another man's. Once her third child, a daughter named Rosalie, was born, it became evident that Eliza was not in good health. Her complexion was pale and sickly looking, and she appeared worn down. Whispers circulated through the town suggesting that her condition was a result of heartbreak and misfortune. As time went on, Eliza's performances dwindled, and eventually she became so sick that she had to stop performing altogether. It was later discovered that the cause of her sickness wasn't just heartbreak, but rather tuberculosis. The theater company and Eliza's circle of friends reached out to David's family, hoping that they would come see the children and help in caring for Eliza during her final days. Sadly, though, their pleas went unanswered. Instead, her community banded together to offer their unwavering support until her untimely passing at only 24 years old. Following Eliza's death, the now orphaned siblings were unfortunately separated. The eldest, Henry, went to reside with David's parents, but they didn't have the finances to care for the younger two. So Rosalie found a home with a family in Richmond who were acquainted with the Poes, and Edgar was welcomed in by John and Franny Allen. Both John and Franny shared a love for the theater, and Franny was actually one of the women who provided assistance to Eliza during her final days. Life for young Edgar with John and Franny would have been a haven of comfort and stability. John, who was a prosperous tobacco businessman originally from Scotland, and Franny, a devoted homemaker with a passion for baking and sewing. They both had vowed to provide Edgar with a top-notch education, and they showered him with toys, books, and even custom-made clothes. Despite their successful life in the United States, John was driven by ambition and wanted to venture into the business world in London. The Allens sold a significant portion of their possessions and embarked on this new chapter of their lives when Edgar was just 6 years old. During their time in London, Edgar found himself spending most of his days at boarding schools. And while he lacked nothing in terms of material possessions, it seemed that the emotional connection that he craved was somewhat absent. Edgar at times went unmentioned in the letters exchanged between John and Franny, leaving him feeling somewhat overlooked. On various occasions, Franny fell ill and was unable to be present as a parent, while John became consumed by his business affairs. Even John's own sister at one point voiced how frustrating her brother's constant absence was. And then there was the elephant in the room that lingered in the background. The undeniable truth that Edgar had yet to be officially adopted by the couple. Now, in a general sense, I do feel like this was a very common way of life. I don't think much thought was given to feelings or nurturing. It definitely wasn't an era of self-care. So I don't think that this was just isolated to Edgar's upbringing. I think this is just how it was. While initially finding some success after the move, it was short-lived, and in the end, things didn't quite go as planned for John in the business world of London. The Allen family found themselves drowning in a sea of debt. Meanwhile, Franny was desperate to return to the United States and be reunited with her friends. So they made the difficult decision to pack up their belongings once again and head back home to start tackling their financial burdens head-on. Once they were back in the United States, it became evident that Edgar possessed a remarkable talent for language. He immersed himself in the study of Latin and French, and especially taking an interest in the beauty of Latin poetry. He also began to explore his own writing abilities, leaving his classmates and teachers in awe of his skills. Edgar wasn't just intellectually gifted, though. He was also fiercely competitive and driven. He excelled in sports, particularly in running and swimming. In fact, one of his classmates hailed him as the most fearless and enduring swimmer they had ever encountered. It was clear that John Allen's influence on striving for success and being the best had now taken root in young Edgar's heart. John and Franny continued to support Edgar, taking care of his education and expenses, and even indulging in extras. In fact, some people even claimed that they were providing him with too much, and they feared that he would become spoiled. When Edgar reached the age of 16, like most teenagers, his behavior and mood underwent a drastic change at home. He became sulky and moody and just utterly miserable, causing significant tension between him and John. You see, John interpreted this as Edgar being unappreciative of everything that had been done for him. In a letter, John expressed his frustration, stating, quote, "The boy shows no affection toward us, not even a hint of gratitude for all the love and kindness we have shown him." So there's a part of me that feels like maybe this is just a miscommunication. I mean, with John's no BS upbringing and tough love approach, perhaps providing for Edgar the way that he did was his way of showing affection and love. I mean, this is a time when poverty was extremely common, so having someone who's not a biological parent provide for you the way Edgar was provided for would have been an inclination, at least to me, that his heart was in the right place, I suppose. But now, having said that, there is another layer to all of this, and that is that it's been said that Edgar had learned about John's infidelity. And he adored his foster mother so much that learning this was not only a betrayal to her, but also to Edgar. So this very well could have been what caused Edgar to kind of keep his distance from John and could have been the catalyst to whatever, you know, relationship that they could have had just completely crumbling. In March of 1825, the fortunes of the Allens would take a turn for the better. Their beloved Uncle Galt, who happened to be a man of immense wealth, passed away, leaving John with a huge inheritance. Suddenly, they found themselves living the lives of millionaires. They bought a beautiful mansion and decorated it with exquisite artwork and luxurious furniture. They would host lavish parties, inviting all the who's who in the city. But all the money in the world couldn't mend the growing tension between Edgar and John. Despite their constant disagreements, though, John still supported Edgar's decision to attend the University of Virginia and saw to it that he was given the funds and necessities to attend. While in school, Edgar thrived academically and athletically, but struggled managing his finances, leading to even more arguments with John. Now, this is where the accounts differ. So on one side, you have John claiming that he's been giving Edgar large sums of money, but he's been gambling and spending it on frivolous wants. And then on the other hand, you have Edgar, who claims John was stingy, cold, and callous, and never sent him enough to cover his expenses, so that's why he had to take out loans and gamble for more. He also claims at one point he had to use his furniture for firewood, and he was nearly homeless and starved to death. Now, Edgar's account doesn't really change, so we won't ever know if he was being truthful. However, it is worth mentioning that it is documented that several people, including the schoolmaster, actually made comments that John overindulged Edgar, and he was really very spoiled. I've read a couple different biography books, and each one sort of leans one way or the other, so I guess it really is a, you know, he said, she said type of situation. So we won't really know. After the school term ended, Edgar was eager to continue his education in the next term, but John flat out refused to pay for it. To make matters worse for Edgar, creditors were relentlessly pursuing and threatening him. Despite his desperate pleas for assistance, John refused to settle those debts as well. The tension between them escalated to a breaking point when one afternoon they found themselves bickering back and forth in a heated argument. The stress of it all prompted Edgar to make a life-changing decision. Determined to forge his own path, he decided to leave the Allens. Guided by a watercolor painting of Boston, a cherished gift from his late mother, Edgar felt an undeniable pull towards the city. Without a word of warning or informing his foster family, he quietly and quickly departed from Richmond, ready to embark on his new journey. When Edgar arrived in Boston, he wasted no time in finding work. He actually took two jobs, one as a warehouse clerk and the other as a newspaper reporter. Although Edgar had always had an interest in literature and writing, he showed no early signs of wanting to pursue it as a career. But something seemingly changed when he got to Boston, perhaps bit with the writing bug. He chose to save up some money and use it to publish a collection of poetry. The book, consisting of 10 poems, was a tribute to his favorite poets and showcased his literary talent. Despite juggling two jobs, Edgar still found it difficult to make ends meet. Feeling at this point like he had no one to rely on, he made the bold decision to enlist in the army. But since he was only 18, he applied using the alias Edgar Perry, claiming to be 22. His book of poetry was finally released a few months after joining the army, but unfortunately, it received little recognition. Much to Edgar's surprise, he found himself thriving in the army and would be eventually stationed in South Carolina. There, in his spare time, he immersed himself in his poetry and began crafting fresh short stories. And although he was excelling in his duties, it didn't take him long to realize that military life really wasn't his calling. His heart wanted so badly to become a renowned writer and poet. So, in an attempt to leave, he confessed to his commander about his false identity and age, all in exchange for an early discharge from service. His commander, who had been sort of a mentor to Edgar, wasn't letting him get off that easy, though. He would let him go on one condition. He had to reconcile with John. Desperate to leave and work toward a career as a writer, Edgar reached out to John multiple times in the following weeks, but received no response. Stuck and frustrated, he decided to take a different approach. In his third letter, he proposed that if John reconciled with him and assisted him in being discharged from service, he would enroll in West Point Military Academy to advance his career as a soldier. Now, we know that his only goal is to make a career out of writing, not being a soldier, so most likely Edgar knew that he had to say something that would persuade John to help him, and the military academy happened to be the exact type of respectable path that John and Franny would want him to take, so that's why he suggested it. Edgar, in his letter, also admitted his fault in blaming John for his financial troubles, attributing it to his own maturity. And this is also an indication to me that John was providing for him and giving him enough money to pay for school, and Edgar just wasn't responsible with it. My thoughts are, it just doesn't seem like anyone would make that statement if it was completely untrue, but that's just my take. He also expressed his love for them and inquired about Franny, hoping she too still remembered him and the love they shared as a family. Franny had always had Edgar in her thoughts and longed to reunite with him, but in a tragic turn of events, she passed away from illness before they could see each other again. Franny's death had a profound impact on John, who softened and embraced Edgar as his foster son once more. John not only bought expensive mourning clothes for Edgar, but also promised to assist in his discharge from the position and even offered forgiveness. This newfound closeness brought Edgar a mix of sorrow and guilt. After the funeral, as Edgar prepared to return to his duties, he reached out to John with a heartfelt letter, addressing it as Dear Pa, and he expressed that despite the sadness of Franny's passing, reconciling with John made him the happiest he'd been in a long time. Edgar's discharge from the army marked the beginning of his poetic journey, during which he dedicated most of his time to his craft. But unfortunately, his newly reconciled relationship with John was becoming strained again. He had postponed his enrollment at West Point multiple times, leaving John to wonder if he had been deceived. And no doubt this was adding to the tensions between them, as John was frequently asking him when he was enrolling, and there was always some kind of excuse as to why it was delayed. Despite this, though, Edgar frequently approached John for financial assistance, and John often complied. Shortly after Franny's passing, though, Edgar approached John once again, this time seeking his influence and financial backing to help publish some of his literary works. Frustrated, John declined to help, but he couldn't help but feel a personal curiosity about Edgar's writing, even going as far as requesting to read his manuscripts. Edgar was eventually able to secure a publisher for his second book of poems, but it remains uncertain if John provided any financial backing. 250 copies of the collection were printed, and it received a modest level of acclaim, but nowhere near what Edgar had dreamed of. It's also important to mention that during his withdrawal from service, it was revealed that he had told several untruths. So, for example, he claimed that his parents were both killed in the theater fire that occurred a few weeks after his mother's passing. And he also claimed that John and Franny had adopted him and he was their heir. It was said by a few that he had a tendency to greatly exaggerate things, good or bad, basically working a situation in order to get what he needed at that moment. And it's these instances that ultimately led to John's trust issues with Edgar. Before finally heading to West Point, Edgar briefly stayed with John, but their constant arguments, mainly about money, resurfaced. John found out that the money that he sent to Edgar to pay off debts from the previous year were not used for that purpose, meaning that the person that was owed was still chasing after Edgar. Despite this revelation, John still helped with some school expenses and bid him farewell. Shortly after, however, things would take a turn again when John sent a letter accusing Edgar of stealing household items, things of value, a claim that Edgar denied. During his initial months at West Point, Edgar was, by all accounts, an excellent student. He displayed exceptional skill in mathematics and French, while also dedicating time to nurture his poetic abilities. His skill and talent soon gained him some recognition among his peers. However, he quickly grew tired of the relentless academic demands and longed for the freedom to pursue his passion for writing. One afternoon, Edgar heard some news that he was not expecting. John was planning to marry a young woman who was only 9 years older than Edgar, something Edgar assumed he was doing to secure heirs. Even though he was hinting at financial assistance in his letters, John seemed to disregard Edgar's requests, focusing instead on starting a fresh chapter with his soon-to-be wife. Frustrated and feeling pushed out, Edgar penned a scathing 4-page letter filled with sarcasm, accusations, and disappointment, declaring it would be his final correspondence to John. Although he was determined to pursue a passion for writing, leaving West Point proved to be more challenging than he anticipated. This time, however, John refused to sign off on his leaving the school, leaving Edgar with only one option. He needed to break school conduct and hope for an expulsion. And so he quickly got to work. With a staggering record of 44 offenses and 106 demerits, Edgar's reputation quickly became the talk of the town. Rumors circulated about his excessive drinking, his reckless behavior, food-related escapades, brawls, and even public nudity. Edgar eventually got his wish and faced a court-martial where he was ultimately expelled in 1831. Edgar's life in the upcoming years remained somewhat a mystery. We are aware that he relocated to Baltimore, where he faced more financial hardships. His brother Henry died at only 24, also from tuberculosis, like their mother, causing Edgar to cycle in and out of depression. And he resorted to taking up various odd jobs to make ends meet, all while persistently publishing poems in the hopes of achieving recognition. At times, he would even reach out to John for financial aid to settle his debts, even going as far as to claim he was on the verge of being arrested if John didn't intervene. Although John occasionally sent him money, there was no further communication from Edgar, and he went radio silent for the next 3 years. In the spring of 1833, Edgar once again reached out to John, desperately seeking financial assistance. He said that he found himself trapped in a seemingly hopeless predicament. By this time, though, John had started a new chapter in his life with a new wife and 3 sons, and he had decided to cease his support for Edgar once and for all. His response was cold and unambiguous, making it abundantly clear that he wanted nothing to do with him anymore. Less than a year later, John fell gravely ill. When Edgar got wind of his deteriorating health, he made an attempt to visit him. However, John's new wife, Louisa, tried to block Edgar's entry into John's room. Despite her efforts, Edgar managed to push past her. In a frail state, confined to a wheelchair, John defiantly raised his cane and angrily demanded that Edgar leave. Just a few weeks later, John Allen passed away. In his will, John specified that his extensive wealth should be divided among his wife, sons, sisters, illegitimate children, and Franny's family. There was no mention of Edgar, and the court didn't even acknowledge his existence. While he may not have openly stated it, it was clear that the loss of John and Franny and the circumstances surrounding their final days started weighing on Edgar over the next few years. His mood would become even more melancholic than it had been. He frequently became sick, and his consumption of alcohol greatly increased, rumored to sometimes even having a drink at breakfast. He also began using the name Edgar Allan Poe, perhaps an indication for his longing to be John Allen's son and the sadness surrounding the events that occurred. He had a short stint in Richmond trying to secure work as a writer, but would eventually make his way back to Baltimore, where he married his first cousin, Virginia Clem. He was 27 and she was 13. Now, while it wasn't completely uncommon for teen marriages to occur, typically with the man being much older, and of course for centuries prior it was considered a normal way of life, it still could have been considered scandalous. Scholars can't quite agree. Edgar put Virginia's age as 21 on the original marriage certificate, so there is reason to believe that he thought it would be somewhat scandalous and was worried about what others would think. But then they had a public marriage a year later when she was 14, so I'm not really sure what difference a year would make, 13 to 14. Also interesting, on occasion he was known to say that she was older than she was, sometimes saying 15 or 20, and he would say that he was in his early 20s. So I'm sure that he knew some people would question the age gap. It's also said that for several years they had separate bedrooms and he did not assume the position of husband. While in Richmond, Edgar was briefly employed at the Southern Literary Messenger, which was a monthly magazine that showcased various literary works, such as poems, nonfiction, and legal articles. Although he was finally working in the field that he wanted to, he still greatly struggled with drinking and depression, which hindered his ability to fulfill the responsibilities of the position. Eventually, his unreliability led to either his dismissal or resignation. The exact circumstances aren't clear. Edgar dedicated the next few years to writing, although constantly facing financial struggles and uncertainty, which I'm sure any of us who have had a passion in the arts can relate. Despite the challenges of putting food on the table, he persevered and eventually found some success in the literary world. His writing skills improved over time, leading to the writing of his first novel, The Narrative of Arthur Gordon Pym of Nantucket, as well as numerous articles, reviews, and even a collection of work titled The Grotesque and Arabesque. The collection received mixed reviews, though, and didn't bring in much money, but determined as ever, Edgar continued to push forward. In 1838, Edgar and Virginia relocated to Philadelphia, where he would keep working toward that literary career. He wrote many now famous works, such as The Black Cat, The Pit and the Pendulum, The Fall of the House of Usher, and Murders in the Rue Morgue, just to name a few. Murders of the Rue Morgue is of particular importance because it's thought of as the first detective story, which is why Poe is often referred to as the father of the detective story. Although he was definitely becoming more known, he had yet to reach the success that he dreamed of and was still really struggling, not only financially, but personally with his mood and addiction to alcohol. One time, he even drank himself into an alcohol-induced amnesia. Broke, depressed, struggling, and ready to throw in the towel, Edgar declared himself to be in a crisis. He had been working on a farm for some time now in New York when, on the morning of January 29th, 1845, an issue of the magazine, The Mirror, published a poem that Edgar had recently completed, a little poem called The Raven. And just like that, seemingly overnight, he was an instant success. The poem was reprinted and published around the world hundreds of times and was a complete sensation. Critics and the public alike praised the poem's dark and haunting atmosphere. Finally, it was the break he needed, and Edgar Allan Poe quickly became a household name. But, as it always seems to happen, his happiness would leave as quickly as it came, as his wife Virginia's health was quickly failing. Although Edgar had finally found success in writing, and there were tons of prospects and hope for a bright literary future, Virginia's failing health and the inner demons he battled weighed on him, and his mood was constantly shifting from hopeful and optimistic to dark and suicidal. This led to even more drinking in an effort to numb the pain. On his really dark days, he would even pretend to be physically ill with the cold or flu so he could get out of commitments and just stay in his bed for weeks at a time. Soon, Edgar was notified that Virginia would only have weeks to live, and as her condition worsened, Edgar fell deeper into a spiral. He wasn't publishing regularly and canceling any commitments he managed to book, so their financial situation was also quickly deteriorating. It had even been printed in the New York Morning Express that the Poes were in a terrible state and needed aid. The article, titled Illness of Edgar A. Poe, essentially said that Edgar and Virginia were so sick that they couldn't obtain the necessities of life, and it asked readers to come to their aid. Although he appreciated the support and the community did come through to help him, his pride was also impacted. He didn't like being reduced to charity and the publicity that surrounded it. So he wrote a response letter to have published, assuring the public that although they are down, they were not defeated. One evening, Virginia, by now on the verge of death, handed Edgar a letter, something she wanted to ensure she gave him before she passed. The letter was one that he had instructed to be destroyed when he became estranged from the Allens, one that he had never read. It was a letter from John Allen's second wife, saying that out of jealousy, she influenced John to neglect Edgar, and she very much wanted to see him to make things right. As Edgar read the letter, he began weeping. At first, I thought this was really sweet and I was very touched by it, but I am curious, and there's no evidence of this, I don't think, but don't you find it interesting that she reached out after his success with the Raven? I'm definitely feeling a little bit suspicious of her intentions. I mean, she's already really rich, so I don't think it's about the money, but maybe she's worried that he's going to slam them in the press or something. I don't know. Just a thought that I had. The next morning, at just 25 years old, Virginia Poe died. Edgar, distraught and in the depths of despair, confined himself to his room and said that with Virginia now gone, he surely wouldn't recover from his illness now. To add insult to injury, a libel suit that Edgar was in the thick of was set to resume its postponement the day before Virginia's funeral. Although the court would eventually rule in his favor, it wasn't at all enough to lift his spirits. With Virginia gone, Edgar plummeted into an even deeper depression, a low he didn't even think was possible, and as a result was absent from writing or doing anything social for many months. He continued drinking, though, and constantly battled shifting feelings of hope to feelings of hopelessness. Louise Shue, Virginia's nurse, became a caretaker and close friend to Edgar, hoping to nurse him back to health. After a year of hiding away, he eventually decided it was time to make a comeback and begin writing again, although jumping back in the saddle wouldn't be easy. In 1848, Edgar wrote a prose poem titled Eureka, which is very scientific and imaginative. It discusses the universe, such as the Big Bang Theory, black holes, and what the future has in store. It was met with criticism. Many viewed it as heresy and the writings of a madman. And Louise would end up ending her friendship with Edgar because it went against her religious beliefs. Truly feeling more isolated than ever, Edgar had a few short-lived romances, but ultimately nothing could replace the love that he had for Virginia. It's worth noting that while Eureka wasn't popular at the time and still is debated, there have been some positive reviews. One by none other than Albert Einstein, who said, quote, Eureka was a beautiful achievement of an unusually independent mind. Determined to get back on track with his literary career, likely not wanting to be a one-hit wonder, Edgar aimed to put himself to work. He had planned to do a small tour, first finishing literary lectures in Richmond, then heading to Philadelphia to edit some poems for a Mr. Loud, and then finally to New York to pick up his soon-to-be mother-in-law and bring her to Richmond for the wedding. Now, before I explain this wedding news that I just hurled at you, it first has to be said that accounts vary slightly as to how Edgar was in spirit these last couple days before departure. A colleague, J.R. Thompson, claimed that he was in good spirits, very excited about future prospects, and overall seemed very well. However, his future bride-to-be, Elmira, claimed otherwise. She said that he looked ill and was sad and actually suggested that he visit the doctor before departing. And yes, future bride. So Edgar ended up reuniting with his childhood sweetheart, who was now a wealthy widower, and the two planned to get married. But I will advise that we have to take what she says with a grain of salt, because although Edgar purchased a ring and it was pretty well known around the city that they were to be married, Elmira also claimed years after his death that she was never engaged to him, that he pressured her, but she didn't actually want to. And this, many believe, was partly due to the horrible rumors that circulated after his death. But put a pin in that. We'll get to that later. On September 27th, Edgar set out toward Philadelphia with a suitcase of clothing, books, and manuscripts. Only he never arrived. He was actually missing for several days until on October 3rd, Joseph Walker, a printer, found a confused and delirious Edgar in a ditch outside of Gunner's Hall, a tavern in Baltimore. It was an election day, and the halls also served as polling stations, so the streets were swarmed with people. Edgar was disheveled and was in a great deal of distress. Some say that he was sick from exposure, as the cold wind and rain that week had been quite intense. In between his groaning and nonsensical speech, he managed to tell Joseph to send for Mr. Snodgrass, who was an editor and physician that he knew quite well. As soon as Mr. Snodgrass arrived, he quickly noted that Edgar seemed to have been wearing someone else's clothes. Not only did they not fit him, but they weren't like anything that Edgar had ever worn before. Fastly deteriorating, it was decided that he needed hospital attention, and quickly. He was taken to Washington Medical College in a private room. Edgar spent the following days slipping in and out of consciousness. He had bouts of amnesia, unsure where he was or how he got there. He had terrible tremors and fevers and grew increasingly delirious, rambling nonsensically and speaking to imaginary things on the walls. Some family and friends came to his aid and would ask what he remembered of the 6 days that he was missing, but he was unable to answer, most of the time just speaking incoherently. His delirium grew violent, and eventually he had to be restrained by multiple nurses. Soon, he began calling out the name Reynolds, but no one could figure out who Reynolds was and why he was yelling his name. On Sunday, October 7th, Edgar was quiet, almost restful, when suddenly he turned his head and said, "Lord, help my poor soul." And just like that, Edgar Allan Poe, the master of macabre, was gone. So what was Edgar Allan Poe's cause of death? Well, no one could say for sure. Snodgrass had concluded that it must have been from alcoholism, knowing Edgar and his love for the drink. Dr. Moran, Edgar's attending physician, however, disputed this, claiming he could smell no alcohol on his breath. He called it congestion of the brain and said his symptoms were of someone who had suffered from exposure. And remember, Edgar had claimed that he was running a fever before he left, so could this have contributed to the delirium? Some believe he simply became too drunk to care about being in the terrible rain and cold. Others believe it may have been a suicide. Perhaps Elmira's claims that they were not to be married were true, and Edgar, in a bout of depression, wanted to end things. But it doesn't explain what happened to his belongings or the fact that he was wearing another man's clothes. Since his death, even more theories have been put forward, some that are a little more convincing than congestion of the brain. One of the more popular theories is that Edgar literally drank himself to death. It was pretty well known that he couldn't handle his alcohol. Even after just one drink, he would be drunk. Although, in the months leading to his death, he made a pledge that he was going to quit alcohol. So if he stayed true to this pledge for the most part, then just one drink could have greatly affected him. And remember, when he left, he had fallen ill, and so any type of drinking on this trip could have proven to be fatal. There are a couple issues with this theory, though. Number one, it doesn't explain why he was wearing someone else's clothes or that he was missing for 6 days. And number two, samples of his hair taken after he died showed low levels of lead, which is an indicator that he may have actually stuck to his commitment of being sober. I believe this is because higher lead and iron levels are usually detected in people with alcoholism, but don't quote me on that, I'm not 100% sure. Another theory is that it could have been carbon monoxide poisoning from the coal gas that was used for indoor lighting. However, when Edgar's hair was tested for the presence of coal gas, it was ultimately inconclusive. So this theory isn't as popular. It was pretty much dismissed right away. Some have said that it could have been heavy metal poisoning. Tests also revealed that Edgar had high levels of mercury in his system, and this was likely because of a cholera epidemic he was exposed to in the months prior. They would treat cholera by giving patients a medicine called calomel, which was a mixture containing mercury. It was actually used for almost everything, from the flu to bronchitis, and essentially, it was like a laxative that flushed out the system, and they hoped, I guess, that they would be able to flush out your illness. However, the problem with this theory is that the amount that he tested positive for was still well below the amount that would be needed for fatal poisoning. And then there was the rabies theory, which actually seemed to hit quite a lot of points. Delirium, hallucinations, rapid pulse, fever, and shallow breathing, those are all symptoms. But there was no evidence of an animal bite, and it is incredibly rare to get infected by just an open wound. It can happen, but it is incredibly rare. Also, we still have the clothing issue and the fact that he was missing for 6 days and all of his belongings are gone. This brings us to the homicide theory. This theory suggests he was murdered by Elmira's brothers. So if you remember, I spoke about this supposed fiance, who later, many years after his death, said that they were never engaged. So the rumor is that her family did not want her marrying Edgar. So when Edgar arrived in Philadelphia, the brothers ambushed him. And scared, he tried to disguise himself, which would explain the clothing. The brothers eventually caught up with him, beat him around, and forced him to drink, making it look like an alcoholic stupor. This, however, still leaves unanswered questions, such as there was no sign of him being beaten. And remember, he didn't smell like not even a single drop of alcohol, according to his attending physician, Dr. Moran. A more recent theory is that he had a brain tumor. So when Edgar initially died, he was buried in an unmarked grave. It wasn't until over 25 years later that a statue was put up in his honor, and so they exhumed him to relocate him to the new memorial. During the exhumation, most unfortunately, the coffin had deteriorated and ended up falling apart when they were taking it out. Edgar was mostly decomposed, but what the workers found interesting was that a mass was rolling around inside the skull. Now, at the time, they thought it must have been his brain, but we know now that the brain is one of the first things to decay, so it definitely wouldn't have been his brain that many years later. But what it could be was a tumor, because tumors can calcify into a hard mass. Several physicians support this, also saying it could be why he couldn't handle his alcohol. This, however, again, doesn't explain several things like his belongings missing for days, wearing another person's clothing, etc. So now we get to the final theory, which I am inclined to lean toward personally, and that is that he was a victim of cooping. Cooping was a type of voter fraud back in the 19th century. The victim would be abducted by these gangs and forced to vote for a specific candidate multiple times, each under a different disguise. Oftentimes, they would threaten their families and threaten their lives. They could drug them or give them alcohol. It was very common. And it would make sense as to why he was wearing different clothes. And if you remember, he was found outside the tavern, which was also a polling station. So this is the theory that I lean the most toward. Only days after Edgar's death, a mysterious obituary by Ludwig appeared in the New York Daily Tribune, which seriously undermined Edgar and his accomplishments. In fact, it started by saying, "Edgar Allan Poe is dead. He died in Baltimore the day before yesterday. This announcement will startle many, but few will be grieved by it. And he had few or no friends." Well, later it was discovered that Ludwig was none other than Rufus Griswold, who happened to be Edgar's arch nemesis. You see, Edgar was also a critic and happened to be a very harsh critic. One of the people that he wrote a less than favorable review for was Rufus Griswold. So after Edgar died, Rufus was determined to stain his character and reputation. In a wild twist, Rufus convinced Maria, which was Edgar's mother-in-law, that Edgar wanted him to become his literary executor upon his death. And Maria allowed it, likely having no idea how bad of an idea that was. As his literary executor, Rufus published a memoir named Memoir of the Author, and in it he said many horrible and untrue things about Edgar. His goal was to completely slander him as a person and his work. Although many people sent in letters in defense of Edgar, this account by Rufus was largely accepted as being true for a long time. Since Rufus was making money off of publishing Edgar's work, he had to keep this narrative going, and he did until his death in 1875. Although for a time it may have seemed like it worked, in the grand scheme of things, it really didn't, because all of these stories, though most of them were fabricated, added to the allure of this man of mystery, and it made the public even more interested in reading the works of a deranged man. And now, in 2024, I think we know which author's name has stood the true test of time. Edgar Allan Poe's enduring legacy continues to captivate readers and scholars alike, even centuries after his passing. His contributions to the genres of horror, mystery, and detective fiction have left an indelible mark on literature, inspiring countless authors to this day. His unique storytelling style, characterized by its dark themes, psychological depth, and macabre imagery, has solidified his reputation as a master of the macabre, and it's clear that his impact on the literary world is truly timeless, and his legacy will continue to endure for generations to come. Although we will never truly know what happened to the master of macabre, it's likely that the mystery surrounding his death is exactly the way he would have wanted it. Well, that's it for us today. I hope you guys enjoyed this episode. If you did, give us a like, give us a follow, and I will see you next time for more Haunted History.